This is Bela Fleck. You're listening to Crossing Boundaries on WOUB.
I'm Mark Hellenberg, your host for Crossing Boundaries on WOUB, and joining me in Studio A of WOUB, Bela Fleck.
Hi.
Hi, Bela. Congratulations on the two Grammys that you just won a couple weeks ago.
Thanks a lot. I'm happy about that, actually.
I was surprised at one of them. I mean, it was great. I'm sure you know which one, the pop instrumental.
Yeah, that was pretty strange.
It was.
Wasn't it? I was so happy that we won. I mean, I try not to get emotionally involved in the Grammys and that, but I've been nominated so many times and I've won a bunch of them. But this time was really special. And I think it's because this whole project has been so important to me and has been such a personal kind of homespun effort. From funding it, from finding all the musicians and the personal connections I've made with everybody. It just felt really good.
And for those that don't know that Bela Fleck won two Grammys, they were for Best Pop Instrumental for the title track of Throw Down Your Heart.
Right.
And for Best World Music Recording?
Best Contemporary World Music Recording. And I'm a voter with the Grammys, so I understand the psychology of the voters. You know, you get these huge lists of things and you try and figure things out. And there's tons of categories. Most people don't vote in all the categories. So people that might know me, like what I do, they're all going to see the pop categories. So if they heard about the film or they have the record and they liked it, they might not even notice the contemporary world music category. So I do understand the psychology of it. But it was a big deal. And what was really cool about it is the tour started the next day, so I could get on the bus and meet these nine great African musicians and say, "Hey, you guys, we just won two Grammys," and that, you know, they've never been involved with anything that did that before, and so they were very excited.
And Basaku Kuyate, who's with you, is also on that recording of Throw
Down
Your Heart.
And so is Anania Ngoliga, yeah, the Tanzanian musician, and John Katime. So, yeah, everybody's on it.
And not to go on about the Grammys, but you've been nominated in more categories than any other artist ever in the Grammy history.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Nominated for 29-113. Congratulations. You also have a new album out. This past album was the African Sessions, Volume 3 of Acoustic...
Yeah, I know it gets confusing. There's all these numbers.
This is part two of Volume 3.
Right. Well, the first Acoustic Planet record was my first solo album after the Flecktones became successful. And I had this idea of Tales from the Acoustic Planet. And it was a mixture of all my old acoustic music friends, like the bluegrass guys, Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Tony Rice and Stuart Duncan, people like that, mm-hmm. Edgar Meyer, mixed with the Flecktones and some jazz musicians like Chick Corea and Branford Marsalis. And I think Bruce Hornsby was on that record. And then a few years later, when I got ready to make another solo album outside of the Flecktones, I made a bluegrass album. And I started thinking that this could be a series. The Tales from the Acoustic Planet was really about all the great acoustic music in the world. And so the bluegrass sessions, I thought maybe could fit in that concept too. But then when I went to Africa and did this project with all these musicians in Mali and the Gambia and Uganda and Tanzania, I realized this was what the whole thing was all about. was leading towards an international outreach and making friends with musicians from different countries and sort of celebrating great acoustic music from around the world.
And you get an opportunity to play with all these virtuosi from so many different countries. But thinking about that, what a huge endeavor to get all this together. I mean, just the accommodations and the recording studios.
This
and
was
just
huge, yeah.
Hooking up with all the musicians, traveling to just visas and everything.
Shots. And, don't forget all the shots and the anti-malaria medicine we were taking, which gives you nightmares. There was a lot of things to get over. In fact, one of the biggest things was when I planned the trip, I was on Sony Records and they... insisted that they wanted to put it out. In fact, stopped me from going to any other labels, and said, "You got to film this project." And I enlisted my brother Sasha, who made the movie. But the bad news was, about a month before the tour, they asked to look at a budget, and then they backed out. And all the flights were booked, all the contacts were made, and suddenly I became the producer, which means it was my money. So that was a bit of a shock, but it's still the best thing I've ever gotten to do. Despite the enormous cost of it. And now getting to do, I mean, this was in 2005. Now it's 2010, right? I'm pretty sure it's 2010.
And it is 2010.
And I've gone through this process of going to Africa, coming back, studying all the material, making the film out of it, making the record out of it. That was several years of work, putting the film out, talking about the film, and now touring with the musicians. So it's been like 5 years of Africa for me.
And the second volume of these sessions.
Oh, right. So that
out.
Was your question, and I've spent 20 minutes going around about.
Okay.
But yeah, so anyway, there was so much more than we could get on that first CD of great stuff that happened while I was in Africa. So I decided to get a second CD out for this tour, and it's only available at the concerts and on my website.
Well, congratulations on putting that out. I was reading about it. I mean, you said you have as much material that wasn't released on this new one.
Yeah, I do. The funny thing is, it's not like it's not as good as the first album. It's just as good. It's just a judgment call. What do you put out? A lot of times I had two great cuts from some people because we would always do extra stuff just so we had, you know, we could make a choice between the best of what we had. But what was the best? You know, everything was good. And the astonishing thing to me, I mean, I'm a really picky guy, and my records are really precise, and I work really hard on getting them really good. And we were in Africa for about 30 days, and we recorded about 40 pieces. And every one of them, by the time I had done, you know, my going through it and picking the best parts and making great, you know, edits and so forth, they stand up to what I expect from my recordings. And I can't quite figure out how we managed to keep the level so high, except that I was inspired, and the musicians we chose were great. So that was the key, and it was like a calculus test. Every day I was figuring out how to play with a new musician in a new style, and it was really intense.
I bet. Other musicians have gone to Africa. In fact, you played with Daguerre, who I first heard on the Henry Kaiser David Lindley album,
right.
when they were in Madagascar. Ry Cooder went to Mali,
exactly,
with Ali Farka Touré, and of course Paul Simon did the South Africa thing, but right. Yours is so pan-African.
Well, I think for me, I definitely watched what everyone else was doing, and I was inspired by it, but I thought that the element of the banjo coming from Africa
exactly
was an important key thing that would make it viable, or there was a reason for me to go. It wasn't just, oh, they did it, now I got to do it, or wouldn't that be cool to do? It was like, there's a reason. The banjo, lots of people have forgotten about the banjo's African origins. And I think it's one of the coolest things about the banjo is that it's so diverse. I mean, it comes from this rootsy original African music, and then it's also Southern bluegrass. It's also jazz, Dixieland, you know. And
right.
If you follow it around, you'll find it in all kinds of music around the world.
I was going to ask you about the banjo because I mean, in other cultures that had slavery, the drums were predominant, but in this country, because slave owners didn't allow drums, the banjo seems to be the predominant slave instrument of the antebellum period in America.
It was a less threatening thing. I've heard people theorize that drums were a way that people could communicate with each other at distances, and so people were afraid, the slaveholders were afraid that they would be able to rebel by communicating with each other and having an uprising.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that. There's a lot of things that I've heard that I can't assess, not being an ethnomusicologist.
Right.
You know, stories of in the Gambia where the akanting is played, which is an instrument that is very much like the banjo. They say that that's the original banjo, and that the people taking slaves would actually take akanting players because the first trips, a lot of the slaves died on the trip over, but by having the music on the ships, they say that more slaves would survive and make it to the New World. I don't know if that's true. I mean, it sounds like tales that are passed down through centuries. You know, folk tale. I just don't know what the truth is, but it's the music was so compelling there. When I heard them play, it's like this sounds like the music of the slave period to me, from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
So that really made me believe it.
But the banjo, then, I want you to play soon, but I'm really interested about the history of the banjo, the fact
right.
that it had the plantation music, and then it made it into early jazz. Duke
right.
Ellington's orchestra had a banjo player, but by the mid-20th century, it seemed like the banjo was a real white instrument, and you'd be hard-pressed. Like Taj Mahal was the first black man that I saw with a banjo on his knee.
Right, for a long time. Yeah,
yeah, and it was almost like the banjo was considered to be maybe even an Uncle Tom kind of instrument.
Exactly. And I think, well, the story of the banjo is fascinating to me because I'm a banjo player, and maybe some of you folks out there will be interested too. But the slave situation white folks started to learn to play the banjo. They were hearing these great parties going on, you know, and learning. And then more and more people started to play the banjo that were white folks. And it gradually, I mean, there was a period where people would put on blackface and imitate the slave music. That was a big part of what happened at first. It was sort of a bizarre turn of events, you know. But after that, there were all these arguments in the late 1800s about whether it was okay to play light classical music on the banjo, or, you know, it was only noble slave music could be played on it. And there were all these inventors making new kinds of banjos, and the banjo was the instrument of the day. I mean, everybody had a banjo in the Northeast, in the South, everywhere. And you could carry a banjo, and ladies would play the banjo in the parlor and put on their good clothes and perform all of that. As time went on, that's why the banjo was around when jazz started, and Louis Armstrong was starting, he had banjos in his band, Cab Calloway, Jelly Roll Morton, people like that whole period. But when the guitar came in, there was a particular recording, and I can't tell you the name of it, where guitar was the featured instrument. And all of a sudden, everyone was like, what's that? That's so cool. And everybody was like, let's get rid of that old thing. Not only is it, you know, have we had it forever and we're tired of it, and this is a new sound, but it also reminds us of things we don't want to remember, you know, about the slave past. So the guitar seemed to be, you know, didn't have any of those connotations. Then, meanwhile, at the same time, this parallel banjo universe is going on, where people are playing, mixing these African ideas with Scottish, Irish, English, German, you know, folk music, mm-hmm. everything. Just the way that happens in this. That's one of the great things about America. You know, you can think of things that you're upset about, but one of the cool things about America is it really is a melting pot. And what happened with the banjo was a great example of that. So then you have this old-time music that develops into bluegrass, and then Earl Scruggs is credited with reinventing the five-string banjo. When he started playing the banjo and doing this rippling, double-time, fast stuff, the banjo had a whole new life. But it also got connected inextricably to the Southern white culture,
right,
to such an extent that a lot of black people nowadays have no idea that the banjo comes from Africa.
Then you have movies like Deliverance
that didn't help. It was a great movie. I mean, but it didn't help. And Hee Haw and the Beverly Hillbillies, which was, you know, an incredible thing for Flat and Scruggs in terms of growing their band and getting that great music out to a lot more people. But it also propagated that sense that that's what the banjo was about. And then gradually that's kind of what it became. But in the bluegrass circles, it was never just that. There was always a lot of people that played it in a lot of different ways.
Right.
And as the 60s and the 70s came on, all these modern new kids came along, like the David Grismans and the Sam Bushes, and they started mixing in the music of the current day. You know, they heard, the Beatles, they would do a Beatles song with the bluegrass instruments. If they heard Led Zeppelin, they would do that. They would start to have long jams, and this whole other kind of music started developing. And I came in sort of in the next wave, like in the 70s, and I was hearing all this sort of new stuff with the banjo, and I loved Earl Scruggs. But I grew up in New York City, so like, what was I doing playing the banjo anyway, unless I was playing something sort of contemporary? Right. That was the only way it could make any sense for me. And so then I got into jazz, then I found out, wow, the banjo actually was in jazz originally. Maybe there's a place for the banjo in jazz now. You know, and then that led me into just all the different areas I've gone into.
In fact, your first album, you did Chick Corea's Spain.
Right. Right, I just loved it. I just didn't see any reason why it shouldn't be played on the banjo, and it was just a matter of figuring it out.
I'm sure Tony Trischka was a big influence on you.
Yeah, Tony was my teacher, and he was a great banjo player and creative force. It also did a lot to sort of modernize the banjo and make it make sense for now.
Speaking of Earl Scruggs and Beverly Hillbillies, I read that that's how you got hip to the banjo, is watching the Beverly Hillbillies.
I did, and it... Yeah, there was this thing. Yeah, which I still like.
Yeah, it's great.
I never
it's
feel
a great
bad
piece
about
of
playing
music.
It. Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, Lester Flatt wasn't allowed to sing the song. They had a Hollywood session guy come in and sing it because they thought Lester was too country for the theme.
Is that true? I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to play something else?
Yeah,
anything
I'll play something. Let me something that I learned in Africa.
Totally different than a bluegrass style banjo playing. You dampen the strings when you play, right?
Yeah, I'm actually playing. This is a tune I learned from a marimba player in Tanzania named Cha Cha. So I just liked it because it was so polyrhythmic, and it took me a while to figure out how to play it on the banjo. And at this point, I've kind of moved away from the original version and sort of found my own way around it.
So happens, you know. When you dampen the strings like that, is that the fretting hand that you do that with?
I do it with my right hand underneath my thumb near the bridge. Mm-hmm. So that's the trick. If I just struck it open, it would be like that. But dampening it,
it makes it sound African.
It's a different sound, yeah. But then without the damping.
So the band that is playing with you, the Malian band that's playing with you this evening, Basaku Kuyate and Ngoni Ba. Ngoni is the Malian banjo, right?
That's right.
And the Ba is the bass Ngoni, right?
Well, I don't know.
I think the band is named after the bass Ngoni, and I think...
Really?
I think so. You could ask him.
I didn't know that. The bass player's name is Musa Ba. That's his name. But I don't think they would name him after the bass player. Name the band after the bass player.
I just read that he was the first band that had the bass Ngoni.
I think that Baseku invented that idea, and he preferred the idea of having another Ngoni to having like an electric bass. But he performs the function of a bass in that group.
And they've there's lots four, of Ngoni.
Yeah, there's four Ngonis. They have the bass Ngoni, the sort of medium bass Ngoni, which I guess we call like a cello kind of sound, and then they have the lead high Ngoni, and then they have the medium high Ngoni, which is and they're all tuned a little different. So it's a great wash of Ngoni magic. But they also have these two great percussionists. One plays a calabash, which is a huge gourd that's cut in half, and it sits on a table so he can stand up and play it with his hands. And when he hits down on it with his fist, it sounds like a kick drum. And then when he hits it another way, he makes it sound like a bright
snare sound almost. Yeah, it's ticky sound.
Right, and then there's also a guy playing a little ball with beads all over it.
Kabasa sort of thing.
Yeah. And then there's a great, beautiful, wonderful singer, Anania's wife, Amisako, and she sings, and they're griot. So the griot culture is a whole mysterious subculture in that part of Africa, and these people are the historians, and they pass on the stories. Their job is to remember, and they do it in song, and they do it in poetry, and they remember the things that have happened for centuries and centuries.
There's some great clips on YouTube of Basaku's band on the Jules Holland show in England. It's just some great. I saw that. It sort of blew my mind. I'm really.
They rock. I mean, they truly rock.
They're on a rock label. They're on Sub Pop.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they love to play really loud. The Basaku likes to run his Ngoni through a wah wah pedal, It's great.
Wow. Sort of like Richie Stearns in The Horseflies.
Yeah, exactly. Except he's even more of a soloist. Like, he wants to blow. He wants to be like a rock guitar player on a Zingoni, but he's so good. And then the other people I have are from East Africa, and that's Anania Ngoliga and John Katime. And they are, well, Anania is kind of a force of nature, just one of these magical musical people. And he's blind, and he plays the thumb piano, a big thumb piano that's about the size of, I don't know, bigger than a dictionary, kind of turned sideways. Big guy. A lot of times you see these thumb pianos and there's, you know, 8 or 10 keys right on it. This one's got like 30 or 40. And he plays in a lot of different keys on it, and he sings like a bird, literally. And he sings these sort of super high falsetto things and drops into bass range, and he writes these silly songs. And then he does this traditional music of his region, which is the go-go music. And John Katime plays guitar with him and sings, and they do these beautiful Tanzanian harmonies, and he backs up Anania and helps him around. Because, you know, if you're blind and you're on tour, you need somebody who speaks your language and who can help you get through the day.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so we're all on a bus together, all these guys. And then I've even got a great fiddle player, American fiddle player,
Casey Dreesen
is with us. He's so interested in this music. He said, I'll come and I'll work on the crew if you let me play on a few songs. And he's one of the best crew guys I've ever had, because he knows what the musicians need, what makes us feel comfortable.
I was just over at the hall, and I thought, that can't be Casey setting up the monitors and plugging in the chords. But
not every musician would be willing to do that. That's kind of almost like the Indian... You know, you're going to wash my floor for a while before I teach you the first note. You know, he's so into the music, and his ego is in check. It's not like he doesn't mind being seen by an audience that knows he's a fiddle player, just, you know, wrapping cables or helping people on and off the stage, or, you know, obviously being in the crew. But then on the second set, he comes out and he plays his butt off, so he gets the last word in a way.
We play his latest solo album a lot on the air.
He's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
I was reading your blog that the Malians were watching the Michael Jackson video in the back.
Oh, yeah.
Back of the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we were watching that video of his last...
The movie they just...
The movie of the performance, yeah. That got a lot of play.
You always seem to be... I remember the last time you were here, and it's when your classical album, Perpetual Motion, came out, and you were doing... primarily Bach music and Paganini and stuff with Edgar Meyer. And you were commenting, you really put yourself out on the limb there. As in, a lot of times it seems like without a safety net. And it's...
Yeah, I had some disasters trying to play that Paganini piece. I had one night where I just couldn't play it. It was so embarrassing. But yeah, it was one of the hardest things I had ever tried to do on the banjo. And most nights it worked out.
But most
everything else was pretty solid. I got to where the Bach and the Chopin and the different Tchaikovsky things, I could pretty much play them when I was playing them all the time. But I guess with me, like, I figure I could spend my whole life on any one of these subjects. Like, I could decide I'm going to play Bach on the banjo for the rest of my life, and that could be a whole career, a whole life. Or I could do this African thing. I mean, I've only been to 4 countries and certain regions in those. I could spend my whole rest of my life finding things about Africa to apply to the banjo, you know, or this new playing I'm doing with Zakir Hussain, this great Indian musician.
Yeah,
we're having such a great time, and the music of India is so fascinating, all the rhythms, the numbers, the raga. I mean, I could spend my whole life doing that. I could spend my whole life just doing bluegrass and have a very full life. So since I'm not going to do any one of those things, I take on a project like this for a few years and try and get like an immersion so I can really soak up a lot of what that music is about. And then I stop. Then I go on to another project. And I think my master plan, if I have one, which I've never actually planned, but I'm realizing this must be what I was thinking, is that all of these things will color my musicality and my own composing and my way of playing, so that as time goes on, I will have soaked up the things that I liked about classical music, about African music, about Indian music, and end up with a style that is just me, you know, which is always really what I was going for anyway.
Sure. I think I just heard a piece on NPR, not just, but last year when you were with Abigail and the Swallow Quartet.
The Sparrow Quartet.
And you went to Tibet, right?
Yeah, we went to Tibet, and we were in China and playing with Chinese musicians, yeah. It's great. I mean, the banjo sounds good in a lot of these settings.
It does.
It's an earthy ethnic instrument. So what better instrument to do it with?
You did a collaboration years ago that I loved. It was with V.M. Bhatt playing the Mohan Veena and Jibin Chen playing the Urho.
Yeah, Jibin. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love that.
And it was nice because it was Chinese and Indian and then me. So it was a nice worldly mix, which I love the idea of that. It makes me feel good about the future and the possibilities of humanity if we can get together on some things like this and make beautiful music.
Yeah.
It's a positive thing.
But if somebody said that, oh, we're going to put an air hoo and a five-string banjo and a vina together, you might think, whoa, this might be a disaster.
And a lot of times it is a disaster. I mean, the thing is, it depends on the musicians. And that's what I've learned is that if I'm with the right musicians, everything works.
Yeah.
And so you have to pick carefully. It doesn't work with everybody.
With you playing with Zakir Hussain, the tabla player, I find that banjo and percussion works really well. And when you did the two-part or three-part inventions of Bach with, I think it was Evelyn Glennie playing the marimba, that was such a great sound, the marimba and the banjo. But who would think of pairing those two instruments together?
Well, it's cool. I mean, the banjo will work. Banjo is good at fast rippling notes. You got to work out what fast rippling notes you're doing, but it tends to go well with other instruments that do fast rippling notes, like the kora.
Yeah.
When I was collaborating with Tumani Diabate, the kora player from Mali, we had no problem playing together. We connected just like I would connect with a great bluegrass musician. We felt all the separate notes the same way, and it was easy. But it's also great to use the banjo as the only instrument that's doing the arpeggiated figures and have, you know, long notes like, or even with the flectones, I always felt like it was only complete if someone was playing the long notes, whether it was a harmonica or a saxophone, an oboe, whatever it is, to offset the character of the banjo's sort of repetitive nature. And so part of why I thought Perpetual Motion was a good name for that album, that classical album, is that's what the banjo is. It's kind of a perpetual motion machine. You know, it just keeps... The nature of it is you just keep going and going and going. The hardest thing to do on the banjo is to play slow and just play, let notes hang in the air.
I bet.
Sounds good too, but it's harder to do because we're programmed as banjo players to keep on rolling, keep on moving.
Would you like to play something else? Speaking of rippling notes.
Sure, I'll play something else.
That sounded West African. That sounded Malian.
Yeah, it is. It is. Those are pieces by a guy named Afel Bokum.
That was terrific.
Thanks.
Have you recorded that piece? Or?
I recorded it with Afel on the album, and then I tried to figure out a solo banjo version of it because I just liked it a lot.
You're listening to Crossing Boundaries. I'm Mark Hellenberg. My guest is Bela Fleck. Bela Fleck is performing tonight at Memorial Auditorium on the campus of Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, along with African musicians, a couple from Tanzania, and nine from Mali.
Seven from Mali, two from Tanzania, and two Americans.
Casey, and who's the other American?
Me.
Oh, right. So what other projects do you have? Are you doing something with Umu Sangare coming up?
Yeah, well, I've been doing all these different touring situations with African musicians since this project came out. So I've done solo duet concerts with Tumani, and I've done shows where I went out with Umu, and her band played, and I played with her, and then I did solo stuff as well. And we're doing that again in Australia in April. But then after that, I'm going to be playing with Edgar Meyer and Zakir Hussain through the summer, and then doing some recording with the Flecktones in the fall, and doing some touring with them in December. And then after that, I'm sort of putting it together. But I do have a lot of plans. I'm supposed to be writing a banjo concerto, and that's going to be due in fall of 11. So I got to get to work on that. I've never done that before by myself.
Are you going to get any help from Edgar Meyer on that? Because he's pretty well-versed.
He sure is, and I've written two pieces with him where he kind of ran the show, and I you know, co-wrote, but he had his whole image of how it should be done, and it's time for me to do one on my own without Big Brother, you know. So, but I've learned so much watching him, but I also learned, okay, this is how Edgar would do it. Maybe I would do something differently, so I'm going to see how I can do it that.
That sounds like a major endeavor.
It really is. It really is.
And going out on a limb again.
It is. It's one of those things where I don't know how I'm going to do something, but I make the plan, and then I learn how to do it, and I give myself enough time to learn how to do it, and then I go do it, and hopefully the freshness of it and the discovery of it translates into the final product.
Well, good luck on this tour. You still have a lot more dates coming up on this.
We right? do. I think we have another 19 after today. Whoa. Out of 34, so...
Could you leave us with just one more tune?
Sure.
Of your choice, of course. Bela Fleck playing the banjo. What was the name of that?
Throw Down Your Heart, Pop Instrumental of the Year.
That's right. Pop Instrumental of the Year, Grammy Award winner. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.